Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. The supertanker Brayer spilled all of its 26 million gallons of oil into the sea. Who's at fault? Scott Sterling of the Alaska Citizens Advisory Council says the blame and responsibility go far beyond the ship's captain.
You're talking worldwide shipping and oil producing interests that exist because of the demand of the industrial nations of the world for oil.
And an innovative program to clear the air in Los Angeles has companies buying your dirty car to get it off the road. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont, and by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. The January 5th wreck of the Liberian supertanker Brayer in hurricane winds off the coast of the Shetland Islands dumped 85,000 tons of oil into the sea, twice the amount lost in the wreck of the Exxon Valdez. The wreck of the Brayer is now considered one of the most severe in the history of oil shipping in the area. Following the wreck of the Exxon Valdez in 1989, a series of task forces from each region studied one another in an effort to learn about not only how to prevent oil spills in the shipping lanes, but how to react should one occur. Now, the wreck of the Brayer stands as something of a solemn blood oath between the people of the Shetland Islands and the citizens of Prince William Sound in Alaska as they share this nightmare experience. It was under these terms that Scott Sterling, president of the Citizens Advisory Council in Prince William Sound, went to view the wreck of the Brayer, half-submerged, smashed against the rocky cliffs.
Yeah, we arrived on the afternoon of Thursday the 8th, which would have been about 48 hours after she initially came to rest. And what we saw was we made contact with Shetland Island Council. They briefed us on the situation and arranged for us to take a helicopter overview of the wreck. We did that. What we saw was a tanker leaking oil, but not nearly in the quantity that we had expected. And we also saw severe wind and wave energy at work. It was a double-edged sword. The wind and wave energy definitely helped to disperse the oil very effectively, but it also made salvage impossible.
When the ship finally broke in half several days later, it lost the remainder of its cargo, twice that which was spilled from the Exxon Valdez, though the Exxon Valdez was carrying more than the Brayer. The ship's captain was making way in an authorized shipping lane outside of the exclusion zone. The trouble started when the ship took on seawater that contaminated the fuel oil. The ship lost power and was abandoned, eventually being crushed against the rocks in the gale-force winds that pounded for days on end. Sterling says there was little the captain or the rescue teams could have done. On the other hand,
if you read the pilot manual for this area of the world, which is, after all, been traversed for many hundreds of years by a maritime seafaring people, the warnings in the pilot book about entering into what's called the roost, R-O-O-S-T, the Sumbura roost, during a west-southwest gale, virtually predicts that what will happen is what happened to the Brayer, which is if you have any difficulty at all, you're going to get caught in a combination of wind, current, and wave that's going to sweep you right into the rocky shores of Shetland.
The investigation of the event is far from complete. What is complete, though, is the loss of the oil to the sea. Given the circumstances, the result has been incredible.
Shoreline and intertidal zones are, of course, among the most sensitive zones for life, estuarine life and tidal life in the marine environment. This oil, so far as we could see, provided a light coating or film on the shoreline environment, which appeared to be bad enough in its way, but certainly nowhere near the kind of total immersion and slopping that we saw in Prince William Sound and Kodiak Island in Alaska. That was a marked contrast. I think that we have to do a lot of, and the authorities there intend to do, a lot of monitoring of all basic life forms down to crustaceans, plankton life, and so forth, along the shoreline and in the tidal zones to see how they're really going to fare. Because those are the vital, most basic elements in the food chain. And when the nesting and breeding bird colonies return to Shetland in the spring, of course, they depend on a lot of that for life and for feeding their young. So it's going to be real important to find that out. Now, the oil certainly didn't help matters, but whether it caused a wholesale devastation of intertidal and shoreline life, I think, remains to be determined.
It appears the oil in the water column of the seawater seems to have been dispersed by the pounding sea storm. However, 26 million gallons of oil where oil hadn't ought to be is a factor that cannot be discounted. The testing and the monitoring is only just beginning. Even as the studies get underway, though, Sterling is joining with those calling for immediate reactions to avert future spills. First and foremost, he says, we need a worldwide system of monitoring the location and progress of each and every tanker as it makes way.
That is something that can be done. The technology exists to do it. It is a question of working out the economics and the international protocols to accomplish it. But there is no doubt that if we can make our civil aviation network throughout the world, there is no jet that flies in civil aviation in any, virtually 90% of the world, whose position is not known by some authority at any time that plane is in the air. We just need a similar system for oil tanker traffic.
The other component of this system would be to pre-position rescue ships and equipment for quick strike, especially in and around particularly sensitive areas that would sustain heavy damage should an accident occur. There is no question these measures would cost money, costs that probably would be included in the cost of a barrel of oil delivered.
The economics of just having a tug standing by at all times that may not ever be used causes concern on the part of people who are in the business to make money. But the argument on the other side is, look, the one time that we need it, if it's there, makes up for all the days and months where we never used it, because what it can save is a cost, both in human and environmental and dollar terms, that it far exceeds the cost of having it ready.
A properly trained crew, common languages, and safety procedures are other recommendations Sterling would make to minimize the frequency and the extent of shipping accidents. In the end, though, it really comes down to this.
Everyone has to keep working at this, that you're talking a major, you're talking worldwide shipping and oil-producing interests that exists because of the demand of the industrial nations of the world for oil. So since we're the ones who are creating that demand, we have a concomitant responsibility to try and make it as safe as possible.
Scott Sterling, president of the Alaskan Citizens Advisory Council. The council was formed in cooperation with the Alyeska Pipeline Company, Exxon Oil, and the towns and people along Prince William Sound in the wake of the wreck of the Exxon Valdez. He says as long as we continue to put gasoline in our cars, we are all going to be at the ship's wheel, bringing the oil into port. This is Bruce Robertson. You probably passed one this morning, a 1970-something automobile, coughing and growling down the highway in front of you, noxious exhaust spitting from the tailpipe. Well, if this is your car, it could be worth something. In California, that is. The California South Coast Air Quality Management District is offering Los Angeles area businesses a deal. For $700, a company will purchase a pre-1982 car from its owner, destroy the car, then earn credit toward emissions reductions requirements. Jim Lentz, executive officer of the South Coast District, says this gives companies more time to comply with air pollution requirements.
Old cars in Los Angeles produce a large share of the emissions here. Mobile sources produce about 60% of the total pollution that's caused in the basin. And of that, half of that comes from older vehicles. So there's a real advantage in getting older vehicles off of the road. And we thought this would be the most helpful way of doing it. Most of the older vehicles belong to poorer folks, so it didn't seem reasonable to put big extra charges to force them off the road, but to do it more on a voluntary basis where businesses would get some advantage for buying them off, and people aren't forced to give up their cars, their only means of transportation, but they, if they see an opportunity to make some money, maybe buy a newer vehicle, then they have the opportunity to sell that vehicle. So we thought it was a win-win situation.
The scrap program was tested by the oil company Unocal in 1990. The company took more than 8,000 cars off the road. The district program, which started at the first of this year, aims to remove at least 10,000 cars. Lent says companies receive credit based on the car's age. Older vehicles earn more credit because they generally have less effective emissions controls. So any car made before 1972 equals 108 pounds of smog-producing emissions released by the company that is purchasing that car. Once the cars are purchased, Lent says, the businesses must work with a licensed vehicle scrapper.
And they would make arrangements with that licensed scrapper to take so many cars off the road, and then they would receive actually a certificate of emission reduction credit. These emission reduction credits are good for 3 years, and then after that, they're no longer good. So all a company avoids control for buying a certain amount of old cars off the road is just 3 years. But that can be very helpful to them at certain times.
According to the South Coast District, pre-1982 cars make up more than a quarter of the vehicles on the road, while they create more than 50% of the pollution. Environmentalists in the area agree it is time to scrap the cars most responsible for emissions. But Joel Schwartz, staff scientist for the Coalition for Clean Air, says they are scrapping the wrong vehicles.
The important thing is to target cars because they're dirty, not because they're old. Although older cars are more likely to be gross emitters, most of the gross emitters come from the late 70s through the mid-80s, and that's because that's where most of the cars on the road are from those model years. So when we scrap cars because they're old, we are indiscriminate. We scrap some cars that are fairly clean and some that are fairly dirty. In addition, the most important factor in whether a car is a gross emitter or a clean car is how well the owner maintains it. And that means that a car that's 5 years old can be a gross emitter, and a car that's 15 years old can be relatively clean. The important thing is for people to maintain and repair their cars.
Jim Yennell points to the district's figures as the root of the problem. Yennell says the district calculated average emissions for each car model and year. Yennell of Citizens for a Better Environment argues every car should be tested for emissions individually.
If what you wanted to do was have a program where the emissions that you credited to a company were verifiable, then what you would have to be doing is having some kind of evidence of what the actual emissions of this vehicle are and how many miles this vehicle has been driven recently. The vehicle buyback program, or scrap program, if you will, doesn't give us the kind of assurances that we need to feel that, you know, we are really trading one for one, or, you know, 1.2 for one, and getting actual reductions compared to the emissions that we know are being allowed to continue.
Yennell says the district is trading uncertain calculations, auto emissions, for concrete emissions, those released by industry. But Jim Lentz, the executive officer of the district, says the numbers err on the side of the environment.
The credit we gave per car is actually a little bit less than what we think actually occurs. So there is an environmental benefit to this program.
Lent says the district discounts the credits 20%. For example, if the average emission for a car is 100 pounds, the company purchasing the car will get credit for only 80 pounds of those emissions. Lent says this discount provides a margin of error for those older cars that in fact have cleaner emissions. But Jim Yennell remains skeptical.
The reason they're doing this discount is because they're handing credits to companies to offset real emissions. And, you know, the question is whether or not this 20% really corresponds to anything in the real world, or whether it's simply, you know, a sop thrown in the direction of environmentalists who are uncomfortable with the notion that you trade somewhat fuzzy measured reductions for real live increases in emissions on the other end.
Lentz argues the program does not provide an escape from pollution control. He says it's only a matter of time before every corporation in the district will have to conform with clean air regulations. There is no definite deadline for the end of the scrap program. Lentz expects it will just die away in 8 to 10 years with the advent of electric vehicles and other alternate-fueled cars. Jim Lentz is executive officer of the South Coast Air Quality Management District, the pollution control agency in the Los Angeles area. Jim Yennell is director of the Clean Air Program at Citizens for a Better Environment in Los Angeles, and Joel Schwartz is the staff scientist at the Coalition for Clean Air in Santa Monica. And this is Bruce Robertson. In his book, Earth in the Balance, Vice President Al Gore proposed a worldwide education program, quote, to promote a new way of thinking about the current relationship between human civilization and the Earth, end quote. Professor David Orr has dedicated himself to both the theory and practice of environmental education. David Orr, professor of environmental studies at Oberlin College, has some clear ideas about the current education system and how it must be adapted to teach contemporary environmental issues more effectively.
The mainstream education long ago divorced experience from learning. And the best courses now being offered, I think, in environment are reintegrating experience into the curriculum. But it's a long process. It involves, I think, overcoming the idea that the practical learning and liberal arts knowledge should be separated. And the best educational thinkers we've had in the 20th century, people like John Dewey and Alfred North Whitehead and J. Glenn Gray, people who thought very seriously and deeply about education and to some degree about environment and science, talked about all of them talked in different ways about the importance of weaving real world experience into the curriculum, not because it was important to round out the personality, although it certainly is for that, but it was important to stimulate the mind.
Problem-based learning, as it is referred to among educators, helps students retain more information because they are actively engaged rather than just passively absorbing it. Orr says this process of education does not start in college, though, and neither should lessons in environmentalism. American 13-year-olds ranked 9th of 12 countries in life science competitions last year. The students lack a basic understanding of how nutrients move through the food chain. They lack a fundamental understanding of natural selection and water cycles, as well as the larger implications of deforestation, pollution, and organic evolution. In 1987, the National Science Teachers Association created a task force to address this problem. About a year ago, they recommended that biology be taught with a more holistic approach, combining an examination of science as a process with a study of how that science relates to the biosphere, society, and the individual. In their report, the task force concentrated on grades 7 to 12, but, says Orr, environmental education could start earlier still.
It needs to start as early as possible, and needs to start with the child at age 2 or 3 beginning to explore a habitat. That needs to be encouraged. It proceeds in schools and all the way through the educational process, but it needs to be woven into a curriculum, and it needs to be woven into the livelihood and the pattern of the child. That's why parks are so terribly important, and greenways, places where people can play and experience a natural world. More and more of those kinds of habitats have been lost to urban development and shopping malls and highways, and even the places that are left are often not very safe places.
Parks are more important now, as more children than ever are growing up in cities with no other contact with the natural world. There is also a need for wilderness, larger tracts of land left in its natural state, to be the basic text in our study of the environment.
At one level, there are places that people simply go and experience. And at another level, there are places that within the curriculum that scientists study. And they're terribly important for those kinds of studies to give us baseline data on how ecosystems work and how pristine systems work. They're recreational places. they're educational in every way of the word, in trying to understand how a place works. I heard a story over lunch today about a professor who challenged his class to show him any kind of wild area that had once been used for something else, and to take him out there and show him the places, and he would tell them how it had been used. And his students took him out to an old dairy farm that had grown back up in trees, and he was given the task of trying to explore this and understand how that had once been used. In this case, he was able to deduce from various natural signs that it had once been a dairy farm. But these natural areas are terribly important to give us some kind of alternative way to see the world and also a way to experience the world differently.
Part of seeing the world differently involves re-examining how we think and how we discover information. Ever since philosopher René Descartes, rational or objective thought processes have been preferred over the subjective. Some people now blame this for our separation from our instincts and from our place on Earth.
There's this fact-value split. There is the object-subject split. There is a split we incur in the mind between left brain and right brain. Now, the short answer to that is we don't throw objectivity or what's called rationality out. But what we need is a bigger definition of what it means to be rational or objective. There is no way a scientist can be entirely divorced from what he studies, what he or she studies. And then there is the last element here. A good bit of science, and probably the best science, operates very much through intuition. Now, intuition is not something you can cover in methodology courses in science or anything else, but the best scientist, Einstein, could see in his mind light waves bending in a gravity field at a very early age, long before the theory came along. That was a vision that came to him. And so we need a more rational, broader definition of rationality. We need to think very long and hard about object and subject and where, in what ways those are brought together. But it's not less science, it's a better science. It's a more inclusive kind of science.
Though Orr recognizes the importance of maintaining a dialogue within the scientific community, he says the focus of this new science should be outside itself, educating the public as to its findings. Already the Pew Foundation is awarding grants to scholars whose work combines scholarship with activism, and some scientists are writing books for more general audiences instead of just academic papers for their peers.
And this is education at its best. I mean, communicating these kinds of things to the public that desperately needs to know these things, and I think really wants to know these things. But it changes. A lot of scientists look down on communicating with the public as popular science. But the kind of work that E.O. Wilson does, or Barry Commoner, or Carl Sagan, is very important to the broad public understanding of why we need to build a constituency. In Wilson's case, and has been very active in doing this, a constituency for biodiversity. And that needs to be a constituency that understands not only what the issues are, but why those are important.
David Orr, professor of environmental studies at Oberlin College, Oberlin, Ohio. He is author of many articles and books himself, including The Global Predicament, Ecological Perspectives on World Order. This is Bruce Robertson. And that's our report on The Environment Show this week. The Environment Show is a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. For a cassette copy of this program, call 1-800-767-1929. Ask for The Environment Show, program number 161. That's 1-800-767-1929. The Environment Show, program number 161. Our piece on dirty car removal in Los Angeles was written and produced by Karen Kelly. The interview with Professor David Orr was conducted and written by Kristen Hutchinson. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer, and this is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York and by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont.